Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$1.2 trillion in deficit. Now that is fallout from the financial crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 7th of January. So good to have you here. Let's begin today with a quick run-through on the math for that eye-popping deficit number the Congressional Budget Office hit us with today. For the 2009 fiscal year, that is, the one we're already well into, the federal deficit's almost three times the size it was in FY08. That is, figuring in shrinking tax revenues, as well as $400 billion or so spent so far on bailouts. It does not count the Obama administration stimulus plan. And the president-elect hinted today that the enormous budget shortfall means there are going to be limits on how much more the government's going to be able to spend. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
A balancing act now confronts the incoming chief executive. Experts say his stimulus package needs to be big enough to be effective. His own advisors have said it could cost between $600 billion and $800 billion over 2 years. But some economists have recommended spending more than $1 trillion.
We expect that it will be on the high end of our estimates, but will not be as high as some economists have recommended because of the constraints and concerns we have about the existing deficit.
Obama acknowledged the pressure to find budget savings, and with Medicare and Social Security costs skyrocketing, he explicitly opened the door to cuts in entitlement programs. At the Cato Institute, tax policy director Chris Edwards wishes Obama well in reining in those costs, but also argues he shouldn't be spending $800 billion the country doesn't have.
I think the public really ought to start calling their members of Congress and saying, look, this has gone too far. We're imposing all these costs on the next generation, and this is really unfair what is going on in Washington.
Edwards concedes, though, it's tough being a deficit hawk in the current economic climate. And former congressional advisor and budget analyst Stan Collender says the overriding political reality is the deficit will be getting bigger.
Voting against this would be voting against the equivalent of a declaration of war after Pearl Harbor. This is the number one issue. It's the one mandate the president-elect got on Election Day. That is, fix the economy. And if this is what everyone thinks you need to fix the economy, then members of Congress are going to vote for it, regardless of the size of the deficit.
Collender says the real question is where the limit might be on how much more money America can count on borrowing from foreign investors buying U.S. treasuries.
The truth is we don't know where that is because it's a balancing act and we've never quite been in this position before.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There is a cart before the economic horse element that needs to be addressed here. Before we start digging our way out of all that debt, we'll have to dig our way out of this recession. There was news this morning that makes it look like we haven't hit the bottom there yet. The payroll processing firm ADP came out with its monthly employment report. ADP says the private sector lost 693,000 jobs last month. Bad enough, but it gets worse. The number was 30% higher than most had been expecting. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The employment number lags other indicators. In fact, some economists think December's terrible job figures stem from the collapse of Lehman Brothers back in September. But, says economist Dana Saporta at the investment bank Dresdner Kleinwort, higher unemployment means Americans will spend even less.
So we are very likely to see the savings rate increase going forward. You would think savings is a good thing, but in times like this, it could actually serve to push economic growth down even further.
Joel Prakken, chairman of Macroeconomic Advisors, compiled the data for today's ADP report. He says what's most worrying is the damage being done to small and medium-sized businesses, which accounted for the vast majority of December's job cuts.
Small firms had, up to a few months ago, been clinging tenaciously to their employees, but it looks now like even relatively small firms have decided that they need to shed jobs too.
Pracken says the Obama stimulus package could change things dramatically, but the current forecast for the coming months does not look good.
It would not surprise me in the least to see several more months of job losses of several hundred thousand per month and a total decline in employment over 2009 of between 1.5 and 2 million more.
On Friday, we'll get December employment figures from the government. In recent months, the two reports have differed somewhat. But a new change in ADP's methodology has some economists worried that Friday's numbers may look an awful lot like today's. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
All right, let's go from that jobs report to the deficit for a minute. Stands to reason that when you're staring a $1.2 trillion budget hole in the face, you need somebody to make sure the government's as efficient as it can be. To that end, the president-elect created a new White House position today, Chief Performance Officer. The specific title may be new, but we have definitely been down this road before. Anybody remember reinventing government? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer does.
Reducing government waste is hardly new. Presidents Hoover, Eisenhower, and Truman had various commissions. Of course, Al Gore took a stab at reinventing government. Now it's President-elect Obama's turn. His government reinventor will be known as Chief Performance Officer. Today he appointed Nancy Killefer to the job, asking her to look at the big picture.
Where are areas where we can make big change that lasts beyond the economic recovery plan?
Those other presidents promised big change, too, but failed to deliver. Maya McGinnis of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget blames politics.
Every government program has a constituency, and they lobby hard to keep that program in place.
Government agencies can also be resistant to change, especially if they feel harassed. Robert Bain of the Kennedy School of Government says their reaction will depend on Killefer's role, which Obama hasn't publicly nailed down.
Is it the harassment role or is it the helper role? The signals that we've gotten so far were a very mixed message.
Things get even murkier when you stir in Obama's plans for a multi-billion-dollar stimulus package. Steve Ellis is vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense.
The real challenge is going to be to making sure that we don't create new long-term programs that we're going to eventually have to try to cut.
Leaving a mess for the inevitable commissions on waste in the future. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Believe it or not, it was not that deficit report that sent Wall Street running for cover today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Once you wrap your brain around the numbers, trillion-dollar deficits and a stimulus nearly that big, it's easier to appreciate the rock and the hard place that Barack Obama finds himself between, ever-increasing deficits or a stuck economy. Commentator David Frum sympathizes, but he worries the president-elect has already gone too far in one direction.
Americans will eat anything if it is toasted and held together with a couple of toothpicks and has lettuce sticking out of the sides, preferably a little wilted. So said Raymond Chandler's fictional private eye, Philip Marlowe. He could have added, and anything Americans still won't swallow, we can put in Barack Obama's stimulus package. The Wall Street Journal reported Tuesday that President-elect Obama plans to offer states up to $7 billion if they will pay unemployment benefits to laid-off part-time workers who would not normally qualify. Obama will also press states to include workers who wouldn't otherwise qualify into their Medicaid programs. Obama is reportedly proposing that these two new social programs expire after 2 years. But here's another saying, and it isn't fiction. In government, there is nothing more permanent than a temporary program. So, how is all of this to be paid for? We are heading for a $1 trillion deficit, as Obama himself acknowledges. Probably years of deficits in the $1 trillion neighborhood. Relative to GDP, these would be the biggest deficit since World War II, twice as big as the biggest of the deficits of the 1980s. It gets worse. All of this is happening before the baby boomers have begun to retire. What happens when the 78 million boomers begin to claim pensions and Medicare? Economists disagree whether a fiscal stimulus is really needed. Many argue that the best way to fight a recession is with monetary policy. But even if fiscal stimulus is the right way to go, we need to keep our heads. Don't allow fiscal stimulus to become a disguise for permanent expansions in the size and cost of government, especially at a time when the bill for past permanent expansions is soon so massively to come due. The irony is, if Obama disregards caution and indulges his ideology now, ballooning the deficit beyond all reason, he may find himself spending his second term desperately and belatedly cutting the very same government he came to office eager to expand.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Congressman Barney Frank has been leading bailout negotiations with the current White House and with the next one. He also chairs the House Financial Services Committee, and if this past fall is any guide, he's going to be at the table as the Obama administration stimulus package is put together, too. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, said today that he's going to leave it to the Obama administration to figure out how to ask for the second half of the TARP, that $350 billion that's still out there. What's your answer going to be?
I hope it will be yes, but there will be certain conditions. If we can get it established that a large chunk of the money has to go for preventing foreclosures, if we can make sure that money that is invested in banks is relent, if we can make it clear that there will be money available to help with auto loans, that it will be able to help with municipalities that have been stuck, then I think you can get it. So we are in conversations now with the Obama people, and our intention is, frankly, to put a bill on the floor of the House next week.
Once this bailout package does get approved, if your negotiations with the Obama administration work out, you've got lots else on your plate. Number one that comes to my mind is regulating the financial industry. What can we look for there out of your committee?
Well, that's going to be a very high priority for us. There are a couple of things. First of all, we will put in rules that will keep you from making loans to people who shouldn't have gotten the loans and who can't repay them. Secondly, we have this problem that there's a whole new set of unregulated activities that grew up. Collateralized debt obligation derivatives and credit default swaps. So the number one priority here is to pass rules that don't allow anybody in the economy to make the kind of loans and to get so indebted that they can't pay back and they can cause systemic failure. So we need to create a risk regulator in the federal government that covers hedge funds and private equity and investment houses and everybody else so that we don't have a Bear Stearns and we don't have a Lehman Brothers coming up again.
Who should that be? Should it be somebody brand new, or should it be, say, the chairman of the Fed?
I think it should be the Federal Reserve. This isn't easy stuff. It's not automatic. There are complexities. There's a degree of expertise, I think, available at the New York branch of the Federal Reserve in particular that it would be hard to duplicate elsewhere in the federal government. So we are inclined to believe, I think, those of us here in the House, that the Federal Reserve should be the systemic regulator. Now, there are other factors that we'll need to do. For instance, it's now clear from the Madoff thing that the Securities Exchange Commission has not been nearly as effective as it should be in protecting investors. And so while we create a systemic risk capacity, we also want to beef up the role of the SEC in protecting investors from fraud.
I wanted to touch on the stimulus package that Congress is going to be taking up fairly soon. Are you satisfied with what the president-elect is proposing? Do you think he's doing enough?
Oh, I think he will do enough overall. I have some difference because I think they may be doing too much tax cutting and not enough direct spending from the standpoint of immediate job creation.
There have been a couple of big profiles of you in the press lately, given your prominence in the bailout negotiations. And there was a great quote from you. You said, you know, the recovery is going to start right before the 2010 elections, and then Obama's going to be set and the Democrats are going to be set. You still buy that for a recovery date?
I think the recovery will begin later this year. And I think the advantage the Democrats are going to have, frankly, is that Obama's taken office with an economy in the dumps. And by the summer of 2010, I think we will have gotten back to normal. That's the optimum from the political standpoint, although that's not what anybody is trying to do. The sooner the better.
Barney Frank, Democrat from Massachusetts. He chairs the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up, the year the music died, or at least went on life support.
Big box stores started to cut their shelf space for CDs considerably. I mean, they see the writing on the wall like everybody else does. They just don't draw people into the stores like they used to.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the new year suddenly looks a lot like the old on Wall Street. Nearly all the gains realized since the start of 09 got swept off the table today as the Dow Industrials fell 245 points, 2.7%, closed at 8,769. My old friend, 8,000. The Nasdaq dropped 53 points, nearly 3.25%, finished at 1599. The S&P 500 trimmed off 28 points and even 3%, wrapped up trading at 906. Alcoa crumpled 10% today after yesterday's after-the-bell announcement of deeper layoffs and production cuts by the world's biggest aluminum producer. A disappointing sales report from Intel pushed stock in the leading computer chip maker down 6%. Energy stocks lost momentum on a 12% decline in crude oil prices. That was the steepest plunge in more than 7 years. Bond prices eased. That lifted the yield on the 10-year T-note to 2.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. What's the connection between champagne and collateralized debt obligations? Head on over to our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos uncorking the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for November. The Senate Judiciary Committee discusses ways to help state and local law enforcement during the economic downturn. And President-elect Barack Obama tackles economic issues in a speech scheduled in Fairfax, Virginia. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've all heard how bad this economy's been for retailers. It was the worst holiday season in decades, right? Well, there's a whole chain of things that happens once consumers stop spending, and it starts with the physical retail space itself. A survey out today from the real estate research firm Reis says vacancies at malls and shopping centers are approaching a 10-year high. The sight of a darkened storefront does nothing to attract foot traffic, of course, so landlords are eager to keep as many tenants as they possibly can. And that is putting retailers in a pretty decent negotiating position. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Jonathan Plotkin is a partner with real estate developer the Jaffe Companies in Illinois. One of their properties is a strip mall in the Chicago suburbs. Plotkin recently got a call from a national retailer who occupies a third of the space. The retailer told him they were closing stores all over the country,
and that this one was on the list to be cut unless they could figure out how to operate more profitably there in a declining market. Well, one way is to cut your costs, i.e. rent.
Retailer and landlord did a deal, and the store stayed, paying 15% less rent than before. Brian Eshelman of Alex Partners helps worried retailers avoid the slide into bankruptcy. He says when banks won't negotiate, landlords are an obvious next step.
Many retailers with whom we're working, we are advising to do this quickly because our feeling is that the first companies that do ask for concessions have a better chance of getting them.
Even if they don't, strictly speaking, need the break. Real estate developer Jonathan Plotkin again.
I had a conversation with a director of real estate from a national chain who told me that they had a mandate come down, and they're very successful, from management saying that whatever deal you're working on right now, cut the rent by 20%.
He says retailers definitely have landlords over a barrel, but he'd rather give ground on rent than lose a tenant that helps keep the entire mall busy. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Today's 3% drops on Wall Street were unwelcome reminders of what economically induced stress feels like. You take plummeting portfolio values, soaring federal deficits, and rising unemployment forecasts, it's enough to make anybody anxious. The American Psychological Association knows a little something about anxiety. It's got a new study out showing one group in particular is feeling the stress of the downturn, as Sally Herships reports now from New York.
Elisa Bennett Hart is stressed out.
Probably 3 or 4 times a week. I wake up after a horrible dream. I dream that I'm being chased. I've dreamed that my boyfriend married someone else and left me.
Bennett Hart works in real estate in Atlanta. She's a single parent still soaking up the costs from divorce. She's already come close to losing her house. Her daughter is in college, and she's had to tap into her 401k.
It's kind of like, as long as I can keep all these balls in play, I'm fine. But if I ever drop one of them, they're all likely to be on the floor.
It's not surprising Bennett Hart says she's feeling anxious. It turns out women say they're more stressed out about the economy than men. To see it in action, we need to stop by a gym on Wall Street. That's where I found Glenn Freeman, possibly the most chilled out guy ever. He's the manager there. So are you worried about the economy right now?
Can't worry about it. It's out of my control. I can't force people to buy and sell stocks. I can't force banks to give up money. But I'm not going to stress.
Nearby, some Wall Street guys were working out. I checked on their anxiety levels.
It's got a bottom at some point, right? It always does. It will again.
I'm not all that stressed out about it.
You're not?
Not particularly.
To cope, men distract themselves.
Things that take their mind off of what they are stressed about and that concentrate their minds on something else.
Karina Davidson is a psychology professor at Columbia Medical School. She says often men turn towards solitary activities like woodworking and video games when feeling anxious. I asked her why women's nerves seem to take a bigger hit from the downturn than men's.
There's actually psychological research to suggest that girls from a very early age are reinforced for showing their fear or their anxiety or their distress.
While boys, Davidson says, from early as toddlerhood, are punished for showing the same emotions. So, she says, it's not yet clear if women are actually more stressed out or just more quick to talk about it. But women and minorities, she says, are often the people who work part-time jobs and have less time at their companies. So with jobs declining, they know they're going to be first in line to lose them. Back in Atlanta, single mom Elisa Bennett Hart is still struggling.
I'm looking forward to the day when my subconscious does not have to have free rein. But if it's got to come out, it's got to come out.
Neither men nor women, Davidson says, are better at dealing with anxiety. And she says, nearly half of all adults said their stress has increased this year. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Nielsen released its figures for 2008 music sales the other day. The stats all point in one direction, digital. Between song downloads and ringtones, actual CDs are starting to feel as outdated as cassettes or 8-tracks. We've got Steve Knopper with us for a look back at the year in the music business. He covers the recording industry for Rolling Stone magazine. Steve, good to talk to you.
You too. Thanks very much for having me.
So was 2008 the year finally that the lines on the chart crossed and CDs died and digital sort of became ascendant?
You know, I think that you could make the case that that was the closest year so far. The lines are definitely going in opposite directions. Digital music is going way up. CD sales are going way down.
And yet CDs are still selling, I mean, millions and millions of them.
Yep. I don't think they're ever going to go entirely away. But what clearly happened this year was that the places that sell the most CDs, such as Walmart and Best Buy and Target, those big box stores started to cut their shelf space for CDs considerably. I mean, they see the writing on the wall like everybody else does. They just don't draw people into the stores like they used to.
How much of a problem is that in terms of profitability for the recording industry, though?
Yeah, you know, I make the analogy of you own a Saks Fifth Avenue and it's really successful. And then one day people stop coming into your store. So you say, well, I'm going to change my business model. I'm going to start an Everything's a Dollar store. Okay, well, the next day everybody comes into the Everything's a Dollar store and you have tons of business, but it's certainly not as high a profit margin. I mean, the record labels can make a lot more money on an $18 CD than they can make on a 99-cent download, even though downloads are selling just fine. I mean, I think they top the $1 billion mark. So that part of the business is very successful, but it's not necessarily a great thing for the major record labels.
What do you make of the news yesterday about Apple introducing variable pricing on iTunes? More popular songs at I think, $1.29 or $1.39, and then the old standards at 69 cents?
It's something that the record labels have been pushing Steve Jobs and Apple to do for a long, long time. I mean, their original contract that called for 99 cents for everything was unfair. The record labels have been saying that for years. So it's interesting to me that Steve Jobs would say, okay, all right, we'll do it this way. From a consumer perspective, it kind of makes sense. I was talking to a guy this morning who was saying, you know, if they sell all their catalog stuff, the older material, for 69 cents, that's a really good cheap price. I'm going to just go click, 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 and just get all the catalogs of all the artists that I was missing. You know, the $1.29 may put people off from I assume, what will be the big popular hits, but it's probably a smart idea.
Let me ask you about something I saw in the data as I was looking through these numbers, getting ready to chat with you. There was a thing in there that just kind of amazed me. LP sales, that is vinyl, was up like 90%.
Well, first of all, it's still a really tiny portion of the marketplace. But it's really interesting because what's happening is that you've got all these college students and other hipsters who have been downloading for several generations now, since Napster came out in the late 90s. And they've got all this music on their hard drives. And then they're going, you know what? Artwork is pretty cool. And having a big thing to hang on my wall is pretty cool. And just being able to flip through the racks at a record store is a fun experience. And they don't want to just go back to CDs because they're expensive, and you can see that. But it kind of makes sense to buy a vinyl record because there's this sort of throwback quality to it.
Kind of terrifying that the late 90s were several generations ago, isn't it?
It is terrifying. I was just thinking that Napster turns 10, or would have turned 10, this year. And, you know, Sean Fanning is almost in his 30s. So, yeah, it's we're all getting old.
Stephen Opper writes for Rolling Stone. He's got a book out, too, about the music industry. It's called Appetite for Self-Destruction, The Spectacular Crash of the Record Industry in the Digital Age. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, nothing like NASCAR to focus the mind. Despite its ongoing woes, General Motors said today it's going to keep up its sponsorship of the Daytona 500. GM has already pulled out of a deal with Tiger Woods. It's going to pass on spending $2 million for a half a minute of Super Bowl ad time. But the car maker does know where its bread is buttered. Daytona is the most prestigious event on the wildly popular NASCAR circuit. No financial terms were disclosed, but it's probably only coincidence that GM finalized the deal the same day the White House announced Detroit's bailout package. Don't you think? That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shed 245 points, 2.7%. The NASDAQ dropped 53 points, 3.2%. The S&P 500 fell 28 points. That is 3% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, taking stock of how we got here and how we might climb out of this financial hole.
When we create organizations that, in the words of some people, are too big to fail, what we really mean is we can't allow them to fail.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.